Stories about finance and the changing ways of television today. Also, some firsthand accounts from migrants stuck in Greece and also from a victim of human trafficking. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Glad to have you along on this Thursday, everybody. It's the 3rd of March today. Radio listening habits being what they are, at least for now, there's a better than even chance you're hearing this in a car. And the car market being what it is, Detroit reported whiz-bang February sales this week, there is a decent chance it's a spiffy new car. But the thing is, all those new cars that you see around you, they need bigger and better financing. New numbers out today from Experian Automotive show that the average car payment is up to nearly $500 a month. Yeah, that's big business for the banks doing the lending, but for every lender, there is a not always entirely qualified buyer out there. Marketplace's Mark Garrison gets us going from New York with the risks and rewards of modern-day auto finance.
Gas is cheap, unemployment is dropping, and interest rates are still pretty low. All that has Americans swarming showrooms to snap up the new models with their improved technology. And banks are stepping up to loan the money. Terry Francisco is a spokesperson for Bank of America.
We see it as a very safe credit opportunity.
He stresses that the bank's not lending to subprime borrowers. And remember that auto loans are very different from mortgages. Cars are easier to repossess and sell off. Jessica Caldwell, senior analyst at Edmunds, says that means car loans can be easier for banks to forecast.
They know what they're going to get. They know the risk involved and how much they can recoup if they're going to need to repossess the vehicle.
But there are negative signs forming. Troubled loans are on the rise, nearing $1.1 billion last year.
In the past few months, we have seen the loan business get a bit riskier.
Auto Trader senior analyst Michelle Krebs doesn't think a meltdown is coming, but there is concern as more borrowers with poor credit get loans. And the astounding run of new car sales can't last forever.
At some point, there will be a dip. We don't know exactly when that will be or how harsh it will be, but it will come.
Experienced Melinda Zabritsky is tracking the growth in subprime, but still likes the big picture.
When we look overall at delinquency rates, while there's been an increase, they're still pretty historically low. Bottom line, I think the market is still healthy.
It seems that way for now, but if lenders get too much friendlier with subprime borrowers, that could change in a hurry. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
I know people in Washington like to say House of Cards is nothing like what happens there in real life, but after the election season we're having, I don't know. The 4th season of the Netflix hit drops tomorrow, and whether you're a fan of the cutthroat political world of Frank Underwood or not, the show has definitely made its mark. Netflix plowed an unheard of $100 million into that first season of House of Cards, and in the doing, also pulled off the first big success for high-quality online-only television, and things have never really been the same. Marketplace's Adrian Hill has that story.
When we met Frank Underwood back in 2013, he was putting an injured dog out of its misery.
There are two kinds of pain. Sort of pain that makes you strong, or useless pain. Sort of pain that's only suffering. I have no patience for useless things.
I think in many ways that first episode of House of Cards does provide a real metaphor for the changing media environment.
Robert Thompson is a television professor at Syracuse University.
Which is that all kinds of exciting things are going to happen now, but it isn't going to be pretty.
The success of House of Cards helped usher in streaming services as legitimate players in the industry and planted the seeds of cord cutting. Mark Thayer is the author of Televisionaries, Inside the Chaos and Innovation of the Digital Revolution.
It was a huge wake-up call that here was a big new threat, the internet, and it was finally good enough to really be a significant business.
Season one of House of Cards also marked the early days of competition for original content. Today, Netflix, Amazon, and Hulu produce dozens of shows, just as good or better than what's on the networks and cable.
It's led to sort of a feeding frenzy with more money chasing the best writers, the best directors, the best actors.
And a feeding frenzy for us at home, Sure, there have been TV marathons for decades. We could binge watch 24 on DVD or stockpile Friends on our DVRs. But with House of Cards, Netflix gave consumers control over new programs at the start of the season, letting us decide when and how much political scheming we want to watch at once. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
12:01 Friday morning, as in tonight midnight, basically, is when season 4 drops. And if you want to know what it's like at Netflix headquarters when fans everywhere are clicking to binge watch House of Cards, we did exactly that story when season 2 dropped. It's on our website, marketplace.org. On Wall Street today, traders dug themselves out of an early ditch, did manage to finish in the green, but the lows weren't very low and the highs weren't all that high. Everybody's holding their fire until they get the February jobs report. That happens tomorrow morning, 8:30 Washington time. Details, numbers, you know the drill. There's a big European Union meeting set for next week, at which migration will be topic A. To that end, the president of the European Council, Donald Tusk, has just wrapped up a tour of Greece and Turkey, the two countries closest to the source of the migrant crisis, the chaos and violence in the Middle East. And Tusk's message was clear. This is a quote: "I want to appeal to all potential illegal economic migrants wherever you are from," he said. "Do not come to Europe. Do not risk your lives and your money. It is all for nothing." End of quote. Many of the refugees and migrants take their first steps onto the European mainland after arriving in the Greek islands, while borders further to the north are closed. So more than 25,000 people are now stuck in Greece, trying to work out what they are going to do next. From Athens, the BBC's Chris Morris has our story.
If Europe's response to the migration crisis appears to be on the verge of collapse, then this feels like ground zero. I'm at the Blue Star ferry terminal in the port of Piraeus in Athens. There are people everywhere, sleeping under trees. There's a long line of washing hanging up outside the ticket office. And there are lots and lots of small children. This is Fadil. He's from Syria. He's been here with his family about a week now. He says no one really knows what's going on. Some people have tried to get up to the Macedonian border and been turned back. You talk to the smugglers, he says, and they lie to you. Everybody lies to you. You talk to 10 different people and they tell you 10 different things. Another ferry has just arrived, this one carrying about 400 recently arrived refugees from Leros, from Kos. And in about an hour, another boat's coming with 600 more from Lesbos. So they're off the boat, they're nearly all from Syria, and no one really has a clue what they're going to do next. This woman who lives in Athens is going from group to group, telling them that the border's been closed, that people are backed up and are stuck here, and there are grim faces all round.
Look, we are in the street, and it's cold tonight, and if we come back to our country, it's dangerous, war still on.
Sami has just arrived on this latest ferry. He is a doctor from Aleppo. Where are you getting your information from?
From Facebook, Twitter, from our friends. They go before us. They run from the war. They run from Syria. Yeah, we heard from them.
And now you're just looking for some way to get to Germany.
Yeah, actually that's true.
We've moved into the centre of town. This is Victoria Square. It too is full of people, many from Afghanistan. And until a few weeks ago, the Afghans were allowed to cross the border into Macedonia and head north. Not anymore.
My name is Samim.
And you're from Ghazni in Afghanistan?
Yeah.
How long have you been waiting here?
1 week.
1 week?
1 week, yeah. I decided to wait 1 month. 1 month. If there was no way for us, we would come back to our country.
You'll go back to Afghanistan?
Yeah, because we have to.
Samim is 19 years old and he's staying in one of the local camps set up by the Greek government. He knows that in the streets around here there are smugglers who will offer you alternative routes, but he thinks it's just too risky.
It's dangerous. Now I don't want to go with them. I understand it's too dangerous for us.
So for now you wait?
Yeah.
So uncertainty reigns and many people could be stuck here for some time. But one thing we've seen before and we will see again, if one migration route, one escape route closes down, another opens up. It's just a case of where and when.
The BBC's Chris Morris for us in Athens. The Japanese economy is still the third biggest economy on the planet, but it's been sluggish for, what, the past 20 years or more, and even in the good moments, has been about this close to going south. You add in a massive population decline and what that means for the workforce, and it is nothing good. As one solution, Prime Minister Shinzo Abe has been pushing for more women over there to start working. But Marketplace's Sally Herships reports now from Tokyo that it can be incredibly difficult for women to be accepted in the Japanese workplace.
Kumi Matsumoto is 40. She lives in Tokyo. And her life may sound typical. She has a government job and two kids.
She's four.
She was home on maternity leave with her second child when we talked. But that's what makes her special, holding on to her job while she's pregnant in Japan.
I've never seen any pregnant woman being a clerk or waitresses, right? I just wonder what happens to those people.
They leave their jobs. In Japan, 70% of women who get pregnant leave work. Why? Sure, there are all the typical pressures of being a working mom. But in Japan, there's more. Here's what often happens. Say you tell your boss you're pregnant. Your boss says, congratulations, and oh, also, you're fired. In Japanese, it's called matahara, or maternity harassment.
We've heard stories from women. Once they tell their bosses that they're pregnant, they would say that, oh, then I guess we have no more jobs that you can do. It's too bad that you're leaving and I can't work with you anymore because you're leaving, aren't you?
Yukari Hori is the founder of Aero Aero, a nonprofit that teaches companies how to talk to their employees about maternity leave. Maternity harassment happens in the U.S. too, but in Japan, it's really common. According to the Japan Institute for Labor Policy and Training, one out of every five pregnant, full-time working women here experiences matahara.
The management-level people, their family structure is usually where the person works is very devoted to work and his wife is a homemaker. So for those people, we try to explain what it means to be a double-income family. And we try to tell them that their own personal value is not the same as their company's value.
There are even posters in the Tokyo subway advertising the Japanese equivalent of a 1-800 number pregnant women can call for help. Hori's nonprofit exists because Japanese companies don't know what's appropriate to say to a pregnant employee. And employees don't know what to say either. Mitsuko Horiuchi teaches gender equality in Tokyo. She says, unlike in the U.S., most big Japanese companies expect employees to stick around for life.
That means that the workers must work until the retirement age.
No taking time off to have a baby, which means Japanese companies want to hire men, young ones, not young women, and definitely not older women who want to re-enter the workforce after having kids.
Women quit their jobs after they have a child, so they think that this is a waste of money to train the women. That is, I think, justification from the company side.
Horiuchi says in Japan, there's an old-fashioned, lingering discrimination against women in the workplace. Prime Minister Abe has announced a big push to create a society where women can shine, but it can be hard to tell if it's working. Companies say, hey, we're hiring more women, but critics say the jobs they're providing aren't good ones. Kumo Matsumoto again.
In many Japanese companies, especially in big companies, women are traditionally divided into two different categories.
The first, jobs, just like men have. But that's not the kind of job many women are getting. Instead, they're offered work that falls into the other category.
The other is just work for women.
bank clerks, retail jobs, the difference between a job and a career. Professor Horiuchi says these are unstable jobs with low wages, and these are the jobs that half of women workers are getting in Japan. But in a country where wives of politicians are expected to show their support by walking three steps behind their husbands, it can be hard to get ahead, both for women and the country. In Tokyo, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Sally's story was produced for us through a collaboration with the international radio and multimedia project Bending Borders. Coming up.
A couple of times he gave me a ride and I got home, so I just figured he was like a decent person because I didn't die. And then one night I didn't go home.
The second installment of our series on human trafficking. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials up 44 points today, 0.2%, closed at 16,943. The NASDAQ gained 4 points, about 0.1%, finished at 4,707. The S&P 500 increased 6 points, 0.3%, ended at 1993. Let's start with some earnings, all right? All right. The grocery chain Kroger refunded 7% after announcing lower sales. Costco also reported sales that missed the mark. The stock dropped 0.7%. The warehouse giant did say, though, that it's going to raise minimum wage at its stores for the first time in 9 years, up $1.50 an hour. Mining company Joy Global climbed more than 20% with earnings that beat expectations. Glencore rose 0.5%. Why, you ask? I hear you. I hear you asking. The price of iron ore is up 18% this year so far, and you are listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Our healthcare correspondent Dan Gorenstein is in the middle of a 3-day series about human trafficking, about how the healthcare industry is waking up to the possibility that it can be a first responder of sorts by noticing signs that people are being trafficked, being held against their will, being forced to work for somebody else, frequently in the sex trade. For a lot of those victims, the only chance to talk alone with somebody might be a quick encounter with a doctor or a nurse. So here's Dan with a profile of one of those people and one of those encounters.
Jolene Capone was a runner.
That's what they called me. Like, it was in my file. Nobody wanted me because I was a runner. That's what I did.
Jolene ran from the lousy foster homes. She ran from the good ones. Growing up in Boston, this Italian-American kid spent more time in foster care and group homes than she did with her family.
My mother and I have a really shitty relationship, my birth mother and I.
So Jolene almost expected it when her mom backed off a promise that Jolene could come home after she turned 18. Plan B, Jolene moved in with her boyfriend, until that went south.
He was a drug user and he was really abusive, so I had to get out of that situation, so I went into shelter.
Some nights she'd walk back to the shelter and see this middle-aged guy, Daryl.
A couple of times he gave me a ride and I got home, so I just figured he was, like, a decent person because I didn't die. And then one night, I didn't go home.
They went drinking, Daryl convincing Jolene to sign herself out of the shelter, her and her most important possessions. The night ended in someone else's apartment. Then she woke up.
All my stuff was gone. I had an empty purse. And he told me that it was for safekeeping, that he held on to everything while I worked.
No phone. No birth certificate, no social security card, no recourse. Just Daryl insisting that Jolene had agreed to work as an escort.
I said I wanted to go home, but he just kept saying that I had agreed to this and that this was what was happening. Like he was in control of the situation. It didn't matter what I said.
Starting that morning, Jolene's life changed. Daryl was in charge. He decided when she went to the bathroom. He decided when she showered and when she slept.
Just 100% control. Someone literally owning you, running your life, every single inch of your life.
Traffickers often are master manipulators, using whatever leverage to keep victims under control. It can be flattery, gifts, even affection. In this case, 50-year-old Daryl controlled 19-year-old Jolene through fear, threatening her and threatening to hurt the few people close to her.
I knew that he would make good on it because he was violent with me and he had a rap sheet that was like dictionary. It's amazing what screwing with your mind can really do to keep you in control. Like, I think a lot of people that aren't familiar with it will be like, well, why didn't she just, like, walk away, like, you would be amazed just how scared someone could make you.
The late summer of 2011, Jolene traveled up and down the Northeast with Daryl, every night a different hotel, a life that could be vicious, like when Daryl found the tip money that Jolene had tried to hide.
I would get beaten or raped or starved or screamed at in front of people. I only did it a couple of times, but it was like, it could be $5. It didn't matter.
To Jolene, the only thing that did matter was getting out. And one night, the stars seemed to align. After a botched ear piercing, Jolene had a serious infection. Daryl dropped her off at an ER in Boston alone. Here it was, Jolene's chance to escape.
I'm 99% sure they did ask me, like, do you feel safe at home? And all those questions.
That sent Jolene's mind spinning and her heart racing. First, she was upset, angry at the question's routine tone.
You're not asking me because you care. You're asking me so you can fill out your little sticker and stick that in my chart and say you did your job.
She also doubted doctors and nurses knew how to keep her safe, knowing Daryl could materialize in a second.
Are you going to keep me safe no matter how bad it is? Like this person could be violent. This person could have a gun. Like, you need to be prepared for it all.
And Jolene had her own plan. All that running had taught her to stay a few steps ahead, and she had nothing.
Even if I did get away, where was I going? Where were they going to put me? Where was I going to go? Were they going to call my mom? Like, it just, there wasn't a lot of options for me, being someone that really had nobody.
So when Jolene was asked, did she feel safe? She said, yes. Yes, she did feel safe. Looking back, Jolene knows no murmured magic question could have broken the spell that night. But she wonders if someone had seen that out-of-control ear infection for the suspicious clue that it was, maybe somehow things would have been different. It's theoretical. Nobody did. And the 19-year-old teenager in sweatpants went back outside, where Daryl was waiting.
I've got Dan Gorenstein in the studio here to answer some questions about this piece, because, Dan, I've got some. I know listeners have some. First of all, what happened to Jolene? What happened to this woman?
Well, look, I'm really happy to say, Kai, she got away. She didn't get away that night, but mm-hmm. she did eventually get away. Ultimately, the pimp, Daryl Graham, went to federal prison. Jolene was one of the witnesses for the U.S. prosecutors in that case. Mm-hmm. She's since changed her name to Bella Brown. She's in college, living in the Boston area. And what's really kind of exciting about this is she gets her primary care at this Freedom Clinic, which is a free mm-hmm. clinic for trafficking victims in Boston, run by the Massachusetts General Hospital. And she's even on the board there. She's becoming an advocate.
So take it to the next step then, Dan. Once, and you talked about this in your piece yesterday a little bit, about how difficult it is for doctors and nurses to identify these trafficking victims. How do they get trained? How are they taught to do this stuff?
It's really tough. And one of the things that I was surprised by, Kai, is that, you know, sometimes these conversations, these intimate conversations are happening between doctors and nurses and patients in crowded hallways where there's zero privacy in these ERs. And I talked to this one nurse. She's at the Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. Her name's Annie Lewis O'Connor. And she says she really tries to train her staff to listen for any red flags, anything weird going on.
And when they identify them, they should reach out to some of us who have become more educated in this area so that we can actually come together, have a huddle, and talk about the case and figure out a plan.
Yeah, so that's the thing, Dan, right? There's got to be some kind of systemic solution here. It can't be random doctors and nurses knowing what to do.
Totally. I mean, if you think back to Bella's story or Jolene at the time, when she was asked, are you safe? She kind of freaked out. And part of the reason she freaked out is because she had no plan. And one of the most disturbing things here, Kai, is for people who are trafficked, there's like no stability, no predictability. And sometimes the only predictability and stability they have is trafficking. And so that really is putting pressure on the hospitals and these doctors and nurses to be more than that. And, you know, really, that's what we're going to be talking about in tomorrow's story.
These stories are what we call in public radio pieces that have great tape in them, and Dan Gorenstein can get it. Coming up tomorrow, one more story. Thanks, Dan.
Thanks, Kai.
This Just final note on the way out today, which reminds me I need to have a chat with my mom about her throwing away the baseball card collection I had when I was a kid. Late Tuesday night, we learned that a family in an as-yet-unnamed city had been going through a rundown old house that used to belong to their great-grandfather. They looked inside a torn paper bag sitting on the floor, and down at the bottom were seven old baseball cards. I'm going to cut to the chase here. They were authentic Ty Cobb cards from 100 years ago or more. Total value into the seven figures, the experts say. Yes, Mom, that is your phone. You hear a ring in there. She's going to deny she threw them away, by the way. She does every time I bring it up. All right, we're out of here. The Dow up 44 points, 0.2%. The NASDAQ up 4 points, about a 0.1%. The S&P 500 up 6 points, 0.3%. Jobs Day tomorrow, by the by. John Buckley, Deirdre Depke, Eve Epstein, Nancy Fargali, George Judson, Dave Shaw, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. Our managing editor is Mark Miller. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.